Everyone fi come with a heart of love and make we light it up. Illuminate the world and make we light it up. Come with a heart of love and make we light it up.
Hey everybody, welcome to Paleo Magazine Radio. I'm your host, Ashley Van Houten, and the purpose of today's podcast and the book that we're going to talk about is really to get you aroused. And that's kind of a corny way to start things off, but I don't know how else to do it because the book that we're talking about is called Aroused: The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. And it's by Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein. And I'd be lying if I said that the name wasn't part of the reason why I reached out to her, because, you know, it's a kind of a provocative title, right? I read a review of the book in the New York Times and I was intrigued because it seemed like a super informative, interesting, research-based, obviously, book, but one that wasn't super technical or formal and medical and high level. And when I read the book, I realized that I think I was pretty spot on. The book is fascinating. It talks all about the history of discovering hormones and trying to find answers to hormonal issues. And at times the book is gross and kind of creepy and sometimes just super unethical by today's standards, the stuff that she talks about, but it's really incredibly informative. It gives a background on so much of the research and history and medical breakthroughs, as well as just horrifying practices that took place while people were trying to understand hormones. And it's also good to note here that this was not ancient history. This is really like the last 100 or so years that we really even started to scratch the surface in understanding what our hormones are and what they do. So this book does a good job of outlining in a clear way what we know, how we came to know it, and hinting at just how much we don't know yet about the complexity of our hormones, how interconnected and layered they are. Anyway, it's just so fascinating. I really recommend you read the book, especially if you're into nonfiction, but maybe want something a little more titillating than your typical scientific journal about hormonal research. Like maybe if you're tired of PubMed, you want to give this one a try. So today, I'm speaking with the author, Dr. Epstein. She is a medical writer, lecturer at Yale University, a writer in residence at Yale Medical School, and an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. She's worked as a medical writer for the London Bureau of the Associated Press and was the London Bureau Chief of Physicians Weekly, and her articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Daily Telegraph, the Guardian, Parents, and more. So in this interview, really, we barely scratched the surface, but we still talk a lot about the hormones involved in growth, hunger and satiety, menopause, sexual function. Those were ones I thought you guys would be especially interested in. But we also dive into some of the crazier medical experiments and the stories that she talks about in the book. I mean, there's a lot of like testicle removal and replacement in other parts of the body. I mean, that's something that comes up more than once. So anyway, I hope you're not squeamish. But I hope you do enjoy it. I hope you like it. I hope you're entertained and you learn something. And I hope that you share the podcast with anyone you think might be into it. And I hope that you like it so much you leave us a nice review and a rating on iTunes so that we can share and teach and connect with more people. And you know, I think it's really awesome when I see you guys share the podcast on social media, because that's such a, I think, a genuine and sort of real way to express your interest in something, especially on Instagram, because that's where I spend, frankly, way too much of my time. That's where I usually am. So if you do share the podcast ever on social media, make sure you tag me at The Muscle Maven and or at Paleo Magazine so that I can repost you and thank you for helping me get the word out. Okay, so let's go get aroused, shall we? I know, so corny, I know, but it doesn't have to be dirty unless you make it dirty, guys. So just, you know, get your head out of the gutter and enjoy my interview with Dr. Epstein after a quick word about our show sponsor, the Metabolic Health Summit. So the third annual Metabolic Health Summit is going to be held in LA in January, late January, early February 2019. And it's a four-day event hosted by keto expert Dom D'Agostino, who I'm sure you know all about already. And we are going to have him on the podcast as well. So stay tuned. And this event is a place where you can learn the latest science about the ketogenic diet and metabolic therapy from world-renowned scientists, progressive physicians, and top influencers like our favorite Mark Sisson, Rob Wolf, exercise science researcher Dr. Jeff Volek, nutrition researcher Dr. David Ludwig, cancer biology researcher Dr. Thomas Seyfried, and many more. And from what I can tell about this event, it seems like kind of the perfect mix of high-level science and research-based information sessions, as well as nightly networking and kind of fun get-togethers. There's going to be an expo space with new technology and health and nutrition brands that you can learn about. And there is a super fancy VIP gala dinner with all of the speakers and influencers who are attending. So that would be a pretty cool event to go to. And a portion of those ticket sales go to charities like the Charlie Foundation for Ketogenic Therapies and the Max Love Project, which helps kids thrive in the face of cancer and life-threatening illnesses using family support, culinary medicine, and nutrition research. So if you're interested in learning more about this event, who's going to be there, how it all goes down, or if you want to get tickets, you can check out metabolichealthsummit.com. And if you use the code PALEOMHS19, because you are a loyal listener and smart person, you will get 20% off your tickets. So check out the website, check out the event, and let me know what you think. Randy, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
I'm really excited. This book was super interesting and entertaining, and I have a lot of questions. I'm going to try to organize them in my head. But before we even dive into that, I would love if you could tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are and your background.
Sure. I'm an MD who writes about medicine. I write articles and I also write books. I teach medical writing as well, which people always say, like, well, what does that mean, teaching medical writing? I mean, I think writing is writing. So whether you're writing about food or sports, I like to think medical writing, though, biased, I think it's the most important, because I do think that what you're writing can influence how people perceive the way their bodies work. If you write inaccurately, you might be raising false hopes. So I think it's really important that medical writing is done accurately and in a way that wants people to learn about their bodies and learn about healthcare. And I would say my particular focus has always really been on cultural influences on medicine in terms of how we, and when I say we, I mean patients, doctors, people who sell medical products, people who are buying them, how the culture really influences our decision making.
It's cool that you touched on something there about writing about our bodies and our health and medicine in a way that makes people want to learn about it and understand it. And I think that that's exactly what you did with the book that we're going to talk about today, because I saw a review, I believe it was in the New York Times, and I started reading it. Of course, the name of the book aroused, I mean, I was already kind of hooked at that point. But when I read this review, I thought this is such a cool and timely topic. And it's something that our listeners are always interested in. But you wrote about it in a way that, first of all, the average, you know, lay person can understand and follow. But it's really, it kind of hooks you. And I think one of the reasons why is because it's not like it's a textbook about hormones. You talk about the history and you talk about these incredible sort of experiments and when people were trying to figure out what hormones were and how they worked and how to try to solve these ailments that were appearing that people were utterly confused by. And there's just so much going on in this book that I don't even really know where to start. So maybe it would be better if you told our listeners a little bit about what the book was and maybe some the processes behind how you put it together.
Sure. I mean, I always think it's important to have a story for every topic you're going to write about. I tell that to my students. And I think about, I mean, we all know when we read or when we listen to people, it's the stories that grab us. So what I looked for when I was working on the book, it's semi-chronological, but I really looked for what was going on in the culture at the time and what story would be emblematic to understand why this happened when it did, in terms of hormones, in terms of breakthroughs, in terms of what people were doing. So for instance, in the 1920s, I love that time period in hormone research, because on the one hand, we had some wonderful discoveries. We had estrogen was isolated. Soon thereafter, in the 1930s, testosterone, progesterone also. So there were these discoveries that were really advancing the field. At the same time in the 1920s, there were some, oh, let's just call them charlatans, because that's what they were. There were people saying, ah, now that we have these hormones, how can I make some money off them? So the 1920s was a crazy time of people saying, hey, you want your libido boosted? How about that goat testicle I can implant in you? You know, it's an animal testicle, but it's got the same manly juices. I'm sure it'll work. And there were people selling all these nostrums that had supposedly ovarian things in it, secretions that would help you with your menstrual cramps or menopause or all types of things. So I jump into one particular story in the 1920s that to me highlighted this era of great discoveries, but also people hearing testimony and thinking, oh, gee, maybe that's what I'll try. The story that I talk about in the book is this whole craze in America in the 1920s for men to get vasectomies, thinking it would boost their libido, help their brain functioning, all sorts of things. So it was a little crazy that, you know, this is what they thought. There's lessons to be learned, as there always is, from history. Despite the fact in the 1920s that some doctors were saying, we're not really sure this vasectomies are going to boost your libido, there was so many testimonials in terms of men saying, but look, my friend had a vasectomy and said his wife says he's like his 20-year-old self. So 10 friends telling you they felt better seemed to be more influential than one doctor with evidence saying, maybe not. And I think those are things that sort of relate to what goes on today with medical information.
Right. Yeah, that's just one of the crazy stories that's in this book. I want to bring up a couple more so that you can talk me through the stories around them. But I think one of the things you just touched on that was really interesting that I maybe had not thought of was that really we've only known about the existence of hormones, we've only known, even generally speaking, what they are for like about 120 years, right? Like before that, we didn't even know that they existed, much less knew that there were so many different kinds and different places and the way they work together and all that stuff, right? I mean, this is really a very new field.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. I mean, I like to say that your hormones work like your internal Wi-Fi. And I'm not even sure how Wi-Fi works, but I know the way hormones work, that they are chemicals released from a gland that hit faraway targets. When we think about that now, it seems like ordinary. So what? So that a chemical can reach a faraway target. We send emails and we hope that they reach faraway targets. But if you go back to the mindset of someone in the early 1900s, 1905, when the theory first came out, the thinking was that any message in the body had to march along the nerves, like a physical connection. So it was a pretty controversial theory at the time. And so that's, to me, that's remarkable to go back and appreciate that just the person who came up, or the two doctors in England that came up with this theory of hormones, and they were right, how revolutionizing it was at the time, and also how controversial. But now we have to think about what we know in terms of the way hormones work and what that sort of says about what we're learning about our own bodies. So when we think that we like to think of hormones in terms of each one has its own little silo, like horses going out on a racetrack. But the more we've learned about hormones, the more we've realized that they're all connected. So if you're going to take growth hormone, it's not just going to make you grow. It's going to have impacts on your testosterone, your estrogen, your insulin, so that they're all more like a cobweb. That would be the better picture to have in your mind.
Mm-hmm. At what point do you think we collectively started understanding that concept that they are all connected? Because it's cool and it's easy to understand in the book, like the chapters, they do connect, but they do also kind of cover discrete studies and hormones and different ailments that people were trying to fix and through hormone, you know, work with hormones. But when do you think we figured out that there were different hormones and then we figured out that they can work together and it's like a much more layered and complex kind of situation? When do you think that all kind of came together?
I think it's really been gradual since the very beginning, even though it's something that so many of us still have trouble remembering, you know, outside of the medical field. But I think it's been gradual, and like so many things in medicine, It has to do with studying people with diseases. So for instance, we recognized sort of mid 20th century that children born with deficiencies in growth hormone, unless they're given growth hormone, they wouldn't go through puberty. So at first it's like, well, why? You know, they could be short and still go through puberty. No, because growth hormone has to do with estrogen and testosterone. So you need growth hormone to kickstart puberty. So a lot of times it was really from studying people with a deficiency or a disease that we'd realize, oh, it's not just doing this, it's throwing their insulin off kilter, or it's also having this impact. So that's how we started to realize. And now the exciting thing now is we're realizing that this new focus on your gut bacteria, all the germs, the good ones and some of the not so good ones that line our gut, they secrete hormones too. And this is really on the forefront of endocrinology in terms of looking at how are the hormones in our body affecting our gut microbiome, and also the other way, how's the gut microbiome affecting our hormones?
Okay, that's a whole other topic that I had not been aware of or considered. Okay, so this brings me to the next question, which is, for people like me who are interested in this stuff, but I'm not a doctor and I'm a lay person. Again, I'm reading it and I'm very entertained and I'm interested and I'm learning about the history, but I'm also learning how much we still maybe don't know and how complicated a lot of these issues are in terms of chronic disease or any other kind of issues that we're looking to fix through our hormones. So my question is, what does the average person stand to gain from this book, other than being entertained and, you know, like learning some things, but practical information that we can take with us? Because I think sometimes the more we learn, the more frustrated we get, because we're like, there's so much going on here. That's so complicated and everything's so connected that if I feel like I have low testosterone, it really could be a million other things. And so people get overwhelmed. So how do we begin to take this information and use it in a practical way?
Sure. Oh, I'm so happy that you asked that question, because yes, I do hope that my stories are entertaining, but here's what I hope people get from the end of the book. I hope that because there's so much information about hormones out there today and there's people selling supplements, I hope that people can come away with an understanding, not just how your hormones work, but being able to distinguish between what's marketing hype and what are real advances, so that they can make better decisions about their own healthcare. Whether you're a woman considering hormone replacement therapy and you'll have a better understanding of why it seems that it was good for you, bad for you, good for you, and what we think now, or you're a man worried about your testosterone, or you've heard of all these other diseases that you're thinking, are they real or they're not real? Do I need to spend money on this supplement? Should I see an OBGYN, endocrinologist, urologist? I would hope that by the end of the book, you feel that you can make better decisions about your healthcare and you can understand what's real and what's sort of marketing hype.
And at least feel, I suppose, empowered enough to ask those questions instead of reading something and saying, okay, if I want to support my testosterone, I'll take these supplements because that's what they say it does. And, you know, so just kind of being able to feel empowered to do a little bit more research and ask the questions that will get you the answers you need, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So that actually reminds me of one of the questions I wanted to ask. It was the oxytocin chapter. So this brain hormone that helps the womb contract during childbirth, and it's said to help foster bonds, and people, you know, call it the love hormone because it's involved in bonding and things like that. But of course, like every other chapter in the book, it's more complicated than just that. And it was interesting. I read in the chapter that apparently you can buy oxytocin spray, like you can buy this stuff over the counter. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, you know, the funny thing about some of this over the counter stuff like oxytocin is, yes, you can go on the internet and buy this nasal spray that supposedly you just spray around you and the guy at the bar next to you is going to want to bond with you.
Yeah.
What I would recommend is save your money from that bottle of oxytocin and buy him a drink instead. You'll have better luck. The other thing I would suggest, or I'd like to say, is that when you buy something like that, that has not gone through the FDA, that's not considered a drug, you actually don't know if you're getting an oxytocin spray or you're just getting like a water spritzer. You have no idea what's in that bottle unless you took it to a chemical lab. Even if it had oxytocin in it, despite the fact that there's some phenomenal research going on looking into what oxytocin may or may not have to do with social skills, a lot of that research is still in mice and rodents and monkeys. We do not know if you take an oxytocin candy, which I was offered from a clinic in Los Angeles, or if you just spray some up your nose. We don't know how much is tapping into your brain. You know, we have these blood-brain barriers. We don't know how much is getting there. And we really don't know the specifics of how oxytocin works. So, you know, a few things I want your listeners to be clear about. We're talking oxytocin, not oxycodone, the narcotic, which sounds like a joke, but actually people, the names are familiar and people get them mixed up. So we're talking oxytocin. And as you said, yes, we know this is the hormone that squeezes the uterus to get the baby out. That's a fact. We know that this is the hormone that starts your milk flowing to breastfeed. We also know that if you block oxytocin in the brains of goats and rats that are in the process of giving birth, they will not bond with their newborns and they will just like kick them. They will treat them like strangers. So that's how this whole mother-baby bonding thing came along. We know that oxytocin is necessary for mammals to bond with their babies. That's a leap to say, oh, I'll give myself a little extra oxytocin and the person next to me is going to bond with me. We're not there yet. There is interesting research going on, though, in labs at New York University, at Emory, and in other places, trying to figure out what oxytocin does have to do with social skills. So far, the studies using oxytocin to help kids with autism have not panned out, but there is still research going on to see how we can learn about human behavior and also what we might be able to use oxytocin for. But right now, no, I would save your money and not go out and buy oxytocin.
Okay, good. Yeah, because when I was reading this chapter, I mean, I'll admit at the very beginning, I was like, oh, you can buy this stuff? That sounds cool. Like, why not? Take a little spritz, maybe makes you feel a little bit better about the people you're with. Like, that can't hurt, right? But is there also not, and correct me if this is a myth, a hormone myth as well, but even if you could buy legit oxytocin on Amazon and it was what it said it was, are there not concerns about if you're taking exogenous hormones that your ability to produce your own is then compromised? Is that the case with all hormones or none, or how does that work?
Absolutely. No, you're spot on with that. I mean, that's the fears. There are people, for instance, there's a disease that's like a disease that's talked about in magazines and doctors don't feel it exists called adrenal fatigue syndrome. We know that your adrenals can get fatigued, but we know that there's not an adrenal fatigue syndrome, which means, I think it just means like you're tired. There are some people that are prescribing cortisol, like your stress hormone, just if you're a little fatigued, just give some of that adrenal gland hormone. The problem is if you take it, it tells your body you don't need as much. So then it can dampen the amount of hormone your body's already making. Same with testosterone. You shoot yourself up with too much testosterone, that signals your body that you don't need it and will stop your body's natural mechanism of making testosterone.
Right. So I guess then it just goes back to sort of doing your research, having a doctor who I guess you trust and do your research with the doctor too, because in some cases, exogenous hormones or supplementation, those things are necessary, but you kind of want it to be a last resort because it could cause further issues down the line, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Another topic that I thought would be of interest to our listeners is the chapter on menopause. I thought that one was really interesting. And it seemed like, I mean, if you ask my mother, they still haven't sorted out how to alleviate those symptoms. So can you walk us through that chapter a little bit on hormone therapy for menopause and the research on eliminating hot flashes and all of that stuff?
Sure. I mean, I'm 55, so I was writing this book and researching it right when I was smack in the middle of it. And all my friends around my age thought my entire book was going to be on menopause because we all get really obsessed. Like that's, you know, you think hormones, either I had women saying, oh my God, I have such bad hot flashes, or I think I'm going crazy. Or I had women who were past menopause and said like, oh, well, I don't have hormones anymore, so I'm not interested in this. But I'm like, no, we all, like, you have hormones, your husband, no matter if they're young or old or whatever, we all have hormones. The menopause story is interesting because, like so many things in medicine, advances come and we think this is the greatest thing. We realize that estrogen is good for stopping hot flashes for not all, but for many women. So then all of a sudden in the 90s, it became, oh, and not only is it good for hot flashes, it's going to prevent Alzheimer's, it's going to prevent heart disease, it's going to prevent everything. So it became hugely popular. We overhyped it. And then what happened? We found out that estrogen alone, when you take estrogen alone and you still have a uterus, which is such a weird thing to say. I prefer to say if you haven't had a hysterectomy. So for women who have not had a hysterectomy, if you take estrogen alone, it does increase the risk of uterine cancer. So that's why hormone replacement therapy these days has estrogen plus progesterone. Progesterone protects the uterus from getting uterine cancer. Do we know everything about these hormones? No, we don't. But what doctors think now, and we're always doing things with a bit of uncertainty, we never know 100%. What doctors think now is, you know, if you're low risk, if you've never had any heart disease, you've never had breast cancer, if you're waking up every hour on the night with hot flashes the way I was, and some women, it's not so much the sweating, but sometimes this hot flash, which is more than just a flash, I have to say, and anyone that's gone through them, can make you feel really anxious. It's the same sort of, it's not just feeling hot. You feel suffocated, like you need space. Like you don't want to be on a crowded subway. You think you'll go crazy. You don't want to be on a tiny, tiny little plane stuck in the gate. You think you're going crazy. That's not just because you're going crazy. That could be your menopausal hormones giving you a hot flash that makes you feel like you need more air. If you're really suffering like this and not sleeping, for many of these women without having a history of breast cancer or heart disease, these low doses of estrogen and progesterone, the same hormones in the birth control pill but different doses, can alleviate the hot flashes, can alleviate the vaginal dryness, and help women feel better during menopause. It's not for everyone. In my book, I write about some new research looking at the actual mechanism of why do we have hot flashes in the first place. We think we're honing in on one particular cell in the brain that's different in menopausal women versus premenopausal women. Hopefully that will lead to new kinds of treatments. We're trying to look at new, maybe non-hormonal ways to help with vaginal dryness. One of the things that seems to be recurring in menopausal women, and this is not from a scientific study, but from me just talking to hundreds of women, perimenopausal, menopausal, is that we don't realize it when we're going through it. We tend to think menopause is, especially middle-aged women, menopause is something that happens to women 10 years older than we are. No matter if you're 40 or 50, whatever, we just think we're not in it yet until we're really in the full throes. Mm-hmm. So it's those perimenopausal days that can be in your early 40s or mid-50s where you start feeling like on edge more, PMS gets worse again, just like you were a teenager. We tend to think, because it's that age where we're juggling kids and career and family, that most women tend not to think, oh, it's my hormones. They just think I'm doing too much.
It's life. Yeah.
Or this is life and just get used to it. where it actually, yes, it's life, but it also could mean hormonal changes.
Well, plenty to look forward to. It's very exciting. I'm not sure if you covered this, but you were saying that there's some research being done about hot flashes. Do we know if there is a biological reason why we have them, or if it's just a side effect of something that's an internal process? Like, there's no real reason that we need to have them, certainly, right?
People have asked me this before. I can tell you from a physiological perspective, there was wonderful research done by this neuropathologist, a pathologist who studies brains, where she decided, she had been studying puberty, the hormones of puberty, and then decided, she's more interested in menopause as she got older. And she was the scientist that actually honed in on this one cell in the hypothalamus. And that's like command central for your hormones, the hypothalamus in the brain. She looked at brains. I mean, we're talking like the actual brain of dead women. She got them from a morgue. The brains of women who are postmenopausal versus the brains of women who are premenopausal. And she honed in and found this one cell in the hypothalamus that was much larger, 30% larger in menopausal women versus premenopausal. When I looked at the pictures, I can say that that cell looked like blueberry size in the older women, the older brains, and caper size, you know, a little caper that you put on your fish, a little caper size in the premenopausal women. What does that mean? Here's what she thinks. She thinks it means that the estrogen, when it starts to plummet, is sending a signal to the brain saying, this body needs more estrogen. When there's not estrogen in the reserves in the ovaries, the brain just keeps getting bombarded with this signal. And that bombarding of the signal blows up this cell. And that cell, she thinks, has to do with temperature control mechanisms. And they actually are studying a drug, and it's had some good results so far in Europe, a drug that actually taps into that cell and blocks a certain chemical. And it seems to be helping women with their hot flashes.
Okay.
So interestingly, there might be a non-hormonal way to help women with hot flashes, but it won't do anything for vaginal dryness, which is another side effect of menopause. The vagina wall thins, and for some women, sex becomes painful, and there's creams that they can take. Some contain estrogen, some don't. But this new drug and this new research that's going on about tapping into this brain cell is really for hot flashes, and not, it's really for the head stuff and not the vagina stuff.
Right, which both are very important. So
exactly.
We want to have both sides covered. Okay, this might be a little bit outside of the scope of talking about the book, and I realize we're going on a tangent here, but I'm interested. And because so much of what we are concerned with the podcast is, and sort of health and wellness in general, is proactive lifestyle changes we can make to optimize our health so that we don't have to resort to reactive, like medicating symptoms. So are you aware of any kind of lifestyle, proactive behavioral things that women can do to alleviate or to at least deal better with menopause symptoms?
What I'm going to say is based a little bit on research, but more hearsay. So there's not definitive studies, but I'll say two things. In a study of menopausal women and really focusing on hot flashes, this one doctor who set up this kind of crazy thing in his lab, so he actually made women have hot flashes. He got them really hot because menopausal women are more sensitive to temperature changes. So you get us a little teeny bit hotter and we're just going to be sweating and getting really uncomfortable. So he made women do this. They volunteered because I think they were so eager to have any research done on menopause. He did find that meditation and deep breathing, not a specific kind, just sort of unwinding and deep breathing, did seem to help a bit. Not as good as the hormones, but helped a bit for daytime hot flashes. Again, you know, it's hard to meditate through the night, so it didn't help during the nighttime ones. I tend to believe, and again, this is just my hunch and just from doing my research, I do think that learning stress release mechanisms, whether that's meditation or exercise, I believe it does help calm your body and it's positive for your hormonal balance. But here's what I also think. If it turns out that, well, oh, actually the stress release stuff didn't minimize the hot flashes or didn't help as much as I thought, I don't think it hurts to actually learn to stress release. You know, I think it's one thing, you know, if I were to say, take this supplement, there could be a side effect. I think any side effects of stress release has to be semi-positive. So it may not work for all women, but it's something I try to incorporate now. I also think that there's hints of studies of people that get involved in exercise and really get your heart rate up a few times a week, that the reason why you feel better, you know, this runner's high, that we do think that it has to do somehow with something we called your endorphins, and it's like these opioid receptors in your brain, and that if we're really exercising, somehow it affects your serotonin in positive ways. So I do think that there's something, and I just was talking to a researcher the other day, and she said that's what she prescribes her patients. She doesn't like to say exercise because too many of her patients are like, ugh, you know, I hate
no
exercise.
Yeah.
Right. But she says, get moving and get your heart rate up. So even if that means walking a bit faster to work or wherever you're going, try moving your body. She believes that's a huge help. You know, and again, on another sort of wishy-washy sort of this can't hurt kind of thing, you know, in terms of exercise, it's interesting. I find for myself in terms of just positive mood, yeah, I like to exercise and I think that sometimes it can make me feel better. Is it the heart rate or what is it about it? I find that there's a big difference if I'm on a stationary bike in a gym versus if I go out for a run, and I can tell you my runs are pretty lame now at the age of 55. And it's not an age thing. I'm not blaming that. But I would say my running is more the equivalent of moving meditation. But when I'm in the park and I'm in nature and I'm completely unplugged for whatever it is, 45 minutes and kind of moving my body in a running sort of way at a ridiculously slow pace, that does make me feel better. Do I know exactly what it's doing to my hormones? No. But I do have to think that it is affecting your cortisol, your stress hormone, your serotonin in positive ways. And if it's not, it can hurt. It can, you know, it does make you feel better.
Absolutely. I mean, this is making me feel better because it seems like these really high level lifestyle factors that we, you know, Paleo Magazine, but health and wellness people the world over are all touting, which is to manage your stress, to have a mindfulness practice, to move your body and be outdoors. I mean, those things positively affect every aspect of your life. You may not be able to connect it scientifically always or medically or whatever, but like you said, those things don't really ever hurt, right? So if they can help any facet of your life and make you feel better and make things work a little bit more smoothly, why not try it? Like you said, there's no side effects. You're not paying to take deep breaths and go outside in the sunshine. So why not?
And I also want to clarify in terms of de-stressing, and I'm sure you know this already too, and your listeners probably do as well. You know, some stress is good. You have to take an exam. You better get your stress level up a little bit so that you can focus. So that stress is good. The body, when you're sick, that stresses the body in a good way. It jumpstarts your immune system to heal you. So these bouts of stress are actually good. What we think is worrisome is a chronic low-level stress. If you're anxious all the time, if you're mulling over something all the time, that doesn't help you focus. Sometimes it goes beyond and you can't focus when you're that stressed out. And we also do worry that what is this doing to your cortisol, your stress hormone, that it's at this chronically high level. So it's really, I think if people are in a high stress job, if you're a surgeon or a nurse or whatever you're doing, that you have bursts of stress during your workday, I wouldn't say, oh, go get another job. You should be lying on a beach all day, because I'm not sure that's the healthy way to go, because these bursts of stress are actually good for us. It sort of gets your brain going. It gets your immune system going. It's this chronic low level constantly, you know, this it's stress that can lead to a feeling of hopelessness as well.
Right. Right. Chronic stress is the bad one. And okay, so you mentioned earlier too, we talked about adrenal fatigue and lots of, there's sort of two camps that talk about this being a thing. And then people saying that it's not really, your adrenals can't really be fatigued as such. You're just tired, or maybe you're dealing with chronic stress or whatever. But what's the connection with adrenal, I guess, compromised adrenals and chronic stress and chronic high cortisol? How do those two go together?
Sure. Well, we think, you know, the adrenal gland does secrete cortisol. It also secretes another hormone that helps maintain your water balance, your salt intake, you know, just to keep it all regulated. So there are people that can have diseased adrenals. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen. And when you have adrenal failure or a tumor in your adrenal glands, that can really affect your blood pressure. It can affect the cortisol levels. There are people with Addison's disease that don't have enough cortisol that need to take it during the day. So those are real diagnoses that we know. It's the adrenal fatigue that you were saying that I don't think it's a real diagnosis. But again, going back to this chronic cortisol stress, we don't exactly know. There are some theories that if you're stressed and if you're producing this chronically low level of cortisol, it could potentially then throw off things in terms of increase your risk of heart disease, people think. It can throw off other hormones such as glucocorticoids, which has to do with metabolism and breaking down then sugar. So it's all sort of interrelated, specifically how, we're not sure. But the big thing that worries me is the diagnosis of adrenal fatigue and then people thinking, oh, well, I need to take that extra cortisol where they might not need it. And that will certainly shut down your adrenal glands, which is something you don't want to do.
Another particular story and topic that I want to touch on from the book, because obviously this podcast focuses a lot on nutrition. So I'm really interested in that case. There was a boy named Nate who had a really rare endocrine disorder, and it made him just insatiable, and he ate more than was normal, even from a very, very young age. And he couldn't seem to, there was no like satiety signals. Can you talk about that story a bit? Because it was really interesting.
Sure. I spent 2 days with this family, and I have to say, his mother, I mean, I just have so much respect for this woman, because she homeschools her son now. She has to, because he is just compelled to keep eating and he can't control himself. He's only 9. She homeschools him. Her house is the happiest home. It looks like this wonderful school daycare center, and she just keeps him busy. Like 24/7, she is with him so that she can make sure he's not constantly eating into a severely unhealthy state. So here's what we know about children or people like him. There are people that have defects in leptin, and that's like what I like to call the I feel full hormone. When you have these rare defects, there are some people that can get injected with leptin and then they go back to normal. They need it for the rest of their lives. They're giving themselves this hormone. It helps balance everything out. And just like we were saying, everything is connected. So you need your leptin balance in order for your insulin to work right, in order for growth hormone and all your other hormones to be in balance. They're all connected. This poor child, he cannot take leptin shots because he doesn't have a decrease in leptin. He has a defect in the leptin pathway. His body doesn't respond to it. So all the leptin shots in the world are not going to help him. His body just doesn't recognize it. There are drugs in the pipeline. He's too young to be in the trials yet. His mother is just hoping that the older people that are in the trial get positive results and she can use this new hormone treatment on her son. But here's what it means for the rest of us. It does not mean that we can go out and be on a so-called leptin diet, and there are those diets touted. It doesn't mean that we can take leptin shots and feel more full. Good news and bad news from this is that the good news is that we're learning the way the human body works is our bodies are meant to stay alive, which is a good thing, which means that if there is some sort of part of the brain that makes us feel full or makes us lose our appetite, our bodies do not want to starve to death. So for most of us, another part of the body will kick in so that we will not refuse to eat. So that's a good thing. We survive. Yay, go humans. We're going to survive. for those of us that want to lose a little weight, that's not such a great thing. It means that it's more complicated. It means that even if our leptin were okay and a few other appetite suppressing hormones, we can override it. We all know that. We all know that if we're feeling a little full, sometimes, yes, we will just have that dessert for whatever reason, because we're stressed, because we deserve it, because we just ran an extra 7 minutes. So now we're going to have 300 calories to make up for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, exactly. So there's the good and the bad from that. But in terms of the future, there are scientists now really looking into what are these basic drives in terms of what do we know about not just our metabolism, but what compels us to eat? And we're just unraveling it now. What do we know now? Well, it sounds like sort of the same old advice coming around, but there's reasons for it. We know that in terms of sugar levels and insulin and our hunger hormones and our I feel full hormones, that for people that want to be healthy and to prevent overeating too much, you're better off eating little bits at a time. You know, you don't want your sugar to drop so low that you're absolutely famished. We all know those feelings of sometimes when we're stressed a little bit and we think it's related to the cortisol, when you're stressed a little bit, you're kind of not hungry and you can go for the day not eating that much. And then all of a sudden the stress subsides. You've taken the test, you did your presentation at work, and then it kicks into your body. Wow, I'm really low sugar. And you'll consume more calories after that than you would have had you just eaten little bits during the day. So we know it's important to keep the balance of hormones. It makes us feel healthier overall. And it's probably best in terms of the ebb and flow of the hormone system.
In Nate's case, because as you said, it was a pathway issue. It wasn't like he didn't have enough or he had too much leptin or whatever. What's the sustainable plan for him moving forward, aside from having someone who's really monitoring his intake? Because that's a stressful way to live. Like, I was reading the story and it's upsetting because he wants to keep eating and he doesn't understand, like, he's not ever sort of satisfied. And that's a rough way to go through your life when food is a necessary part of your day every day.
Exactly. And it's a real compulsion. So it's not that they're enjoying food. They're compelled to eat it. So I'll just tell you that the mom, Nate's mother, who's wonderful, who right now is just going to help, you know, she leads him during the day saying, okay, we have 45 minutes and then you can have your next meal, you know, and she breaks it up into portions. And then when he's done, he's asking for more. And she's like, okay, we're going to do an activity. I mean, she's just keeping this kid busy and she has to keep her eye on him. What she did tell me, though, this drug that they're testing for people with this rare genetic defect, she was in touch with a 20-year-old young man in England who's on a trial. And he said he must be getting the real thing, not placebo, because for the first time in his life, he's feeling full. And the other interesting thing he said is first time in his life, he's enjoying food. He never enjoyed it before. So it's not like that they're wanting to eat and loving it. It's a compulsion. So for poor Nate, his mom is just crossing her fingers that these drug trials are going to work and it's going to help with this genetic defect that he has.
I think that this chapter was especially interesting for me and for the world that I'm in, because we all know that food, we can have such a complicated relationship with food, obviously, because many of us who overeat, we're doing it for emotional reasons rather than physiological ones, but that often it can be sort of a vicious cycle that feeds on itself, because if we are continually overeating for emotional reasons, that can start to affect us physically, right? Like, can we, through our behavior, turn off leptin signaling or affect it because we're just constantly overriding that satiety signal?
Well, it's interesting you say it. There's two things we now know. One is, which I was shocked, the fat cell, which I used to think was just like a little blob of butter in the body. The fat cell actually is an endocrine gland. So your fat cells secrete leptin and probably other things that signal your hunger. Which means that the heavier you're getting when you get into obesity, your body is getting different signals about how hungry you are, making it harder for some people to take off the weight. So it's not just that they're lazy or they're cheating, they're on a different playing field. In terms of what we can do behavior-wise and leptin, we do know now that, you know, we always learn from extreme cases. people who are anorexic, anorexia nervosa, the kind where you not just from cancer, but you bring it on yourself, those people tend to have low leptin levels, which means that they're hungry. They're not training themselves. They lose their hunger signals because they convince themselves what is a hunger signal isn't. And we do know that when you bring on anorexia, when you're severely limiting your food intake and fighting against hunger signals, that puts the body into stress. And that stressful situation is really bad for other hormones. So you might think, okay, I can live this thin. But what it does is it sends signals to your pituitary gland. And we know for in young girls that it stresses the body so that they stop producing enough estrogen and progesterone. So then they become infertile. And we know that that's a problem. We think we know now that people who are underfed, it affects your immune system, not just because you're not getting the food that you need, but because hormonally, your hormones are connected with your immune system. So it's unhealthy for those reasons too. But in terms of what behaviors that we can do, I mean, I think, again, it goes back to you don't want to get yourself too hungry. You don't want to restrict so much that these signals are just ravenous in your body and then you'll bounce back the other way.
Right. Or be constantly eating past the point of discomfort because then your body can start to maybe adjust to that too, right? Like I know people,
absolutely.
Yeah, if you're used to eating these massive meals and force feeding and, you know, people in the bodybuilding world or people who are trying to gain weight, because most of us can't fathom wanting to gain weight, but there are a lot of people who that's an issue and that's a concern, and people who are constantly eating past the point of what their body wants them to do, that can affect you the other way.
Yeah. And there's certain expectations that we have to have for ourselves too, so we're not stressing out too much. I mean, I know for me, when my kids were younger, I mean, I think I spent like most of my day was in the kitchen. Someone was hungry. I was making a meal. And I think like a lot of people that are cooking meals, I probably by the time I tasted what I was making for dinner, had an entire meal before we sat down for dinner and then had the second one also. You know, so there are just certain things. And, you know, is that hormonal? You know, people would say to me, well, you just had, you know, your kids are so young. It's probably your hormones. I'm like, no, actually, it's my kitchen. It's not my hormones. It's my kitchen. You know, I think we put ourselves into situations where because we're prone to want to eat, because of the smells of a kitchen, because of what's going on, it can make it very hard or tempting or out of boredom or for whatever reason. So there's so many different pulls. And I think for some of us, it means we have to have a different reward system. We can't reward ourselves with, if I'm good all week, I'll get that ice cream sundae. Or if I run that extra mile, I'll eat this. The problem with most of us, unless you're an elite athlete, is we're not burning as many calories as we think. And I think somehow, I mean, I know for me, if I go for a run, I'll be famished. But I know that the amount I'm hungry is much more than the amount I just burned off running.
Absolutely.
I think for some people, for some people that really need to lose weight, you're probably better off not exercising so much so that your hunger stays down. Is that hormonal? Probably.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is Google like how many burpees you have to do after eating a donut or something. And you understand that you cannot outwork a bad diet. That's why everyone says if you're looking for weight management, that it's much more about figuring out your diet than just working out more, because it just doesn't balance out that way.
Absolutely. Unless you're a professional athlete, I would say I like to think of it this way. Exercise is for stress reduction, is for feeling better, keeping your body moving. And for weight loss, it's diet. It's really rare that people just increase their exercise and haven't changed their diet and can really shed those pounds.
Again, going back to, I mean, this is obviously an issue in our world. We've got more people that are obese and overweight than ever before. And we've got these hyper palatable foods and we're overeating them. And it's like a world that's kind of set up to make us have impulse control problems. But how can folks who maybe are listening to this and feel like they have compulsive eating behaviors or they have issues with satiety, how do we know if it may be a hormonal issue versus an emotional, mental, behavioral issue? How can we tell the difference?
I'm not so sure it's that important. I mean, I think that if you do have a leptin defect, you would know. You know, these people are voraciously hungry. I think sometimes people can have thyroid issues. You can get your thyroid checked. And then, and that can be affecting your hunger, either burning calories, you know, if you're hyperthyroid, you'll be losing weight. So I think those can be checked. In terms of lifestyle changes, unless you're on extreme end, I look at it, I see it all blurred together. I think your hormones affect your behavior. I think they affect your emotions. And I think for most of us who don't have a thyroid defect, who don't have a leptin defect, it's not that important to separate out, is this a hormonal drive? You know, when people said to me, oh, you have young twins, it must be your hormones. Well, whether it was hormones or not, I was eating a lot. It could be lack of sleep that affects your hormones. But if your hormones are out of kilter because you're waking up all night with a baby and you're lacking sleep and that's affecting your insulin levels or making you more hungry, it's not going to be a hormone cure, but it would be trying to get enough sleep cure. So I think it's all mushed together and we don't need to separate, you know, unless you have like some huge hormone defect that you need external hormones for it. I don't think it matters that much to say whether it's hormonal or whether it's behavioral, because it's all sort of mixed together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good point. So there are so many more stories, so many more experiments and just crazy, crazy kind of elements of the history of hormones that I could ask you. We're almost to the end of an hour here already. And I think that folks maybe just need to pick up this book and read it for themselves, because some of these stories, I mean, honestly, I'm reading it like this can't be real life. It's so crazy that you couldn't make it up, I guess, but it's just pretty incredible. But I guess one of the questions I'd like to ask you as we're kind of coming to a close here, and this is your world and what you research and what you do, but was there anything over the course of putting this book together that really surprised or shocked you particularly, like a story or some piece of history that you were especially, yeah, shocked by?
I'll say two things. I think one, which I had mentioned, is that the fat cell being an endocrine gland, that really sort of shocked me, because I was like, wow, I just thought it was a blob of fat.
Right.
And I think looking into the history, I hear again, I write about people who have who identify as transgender in the book. And I have so many people saying to me, oh, it's a thing of now. You know, more people now identify as transgender. You know, what's going on in our society? Is this endocrine disruptors? Is the hormones in the water? And no, I think I'm surprised by all these questions. When you go back into the history, we've always had people that identified as transgender, but without a community, a lot of people didn't come forward. So we know from our surveys now that if you live in an area, whether it's an area in the world or a state in the United States, that's more open to people to be able to say that I feel that I identify as transgender. Those surveys have many more people in those communities will tick yes on a survey versus if you live in an area where you worry you'll be discriminated against. So I think I was surprised about how many people are coming forth. I was surprised that every time someone opens up a clinic, a pediatric endocrinologist who is willing to work with the transgender community, that they're flooded. There's wait lists. So there's so many people that are born feeling that the body they were born into doesn't match the gender that they were given. And so I think that we all as a society have to realize what a spectrum this is in terms of gender identity. We have to be more tolerable, and that hopefully we'll find out and we'll figure out the best treatments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was another very interesting chapter. And I guess this goes back to something you were mentioning at the beginning of our talk, which was that so much of this is about culture and about the time and place in which things were discovered and people were learning and how much has changed, you know, in the last century. One of the examples I wrote down here, and I just have to mention it because it's so crazy. It's a great example of how far we've come and some of the everyday technologies we have now that we take for granted. And that is the pregnancy tests. It's in the book that it involved, I guess, but I don't know when this was. You can tell me when in history this was, that a pregnancy test, it was a urine sample that they injected into mice. And after 100 hours or so, they would check the mice ovaries. And if they were swollen, that meant the woman was pregnant.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an ancient history.
That's crazy.
That's the pregnancy test that my mom was given for my brother. You know, this goes back to the late 1950s.
So this was not a long time ago.
This is not a long time ago. So right, this pianistic method is really recent history. And I love to tell the story, which I write about in the book. It was really a female medical student in the 1940s who did some of the initial research that led to that pianistic pregnancy test. And what I love about the story is, one, there weren't that many women in medicine at the time. So she really just like pushed forward, applied to go to medical school, got in. She was at Johns Hopkins. And two, she did this study in medical school that debunked medical dogma before she even graduated from medical school. The other part of the story, going into the basic science of how we came up with the pianistic pregnancy test, is when she did this first initial study as a medical student, the investigator who ran the lab said to her, "You have to publish this. It's publishable. Let's send it into Science, an eminent magazine." But he said, "You know, if they see your name, which is Georgiana, you're not going to get published. So just use your initial." So fortunately, she had a very masculine middle name, Emery. So she sent it in as G. Emery Seeger, and she got published in a prestigious medical journal as a medical student. And that research eventually led to what we know as the modern pregnancy test, which is very modern, which, you know, your parent, for me, my parents, for other listeners, maybe it's their grandparents, were doing that inject urine into the mouse long-term pregnancy test.
That is just so incredible. That's one of my favorite stories in the entire book. And I mean, thank goodness for people like Georgiana who were willing to pave the way and do the extra hard work, because they were not treated the same way as their male counterparts. And so they had to be sneaky to get the work done. But thank goodness they did, or we would all be still using the mouse method, which doesn't sound too great, for me. Yeah. But yeah, incredible. So Randy, thank you so much for taking the time. And I know, again, we've barely scratched the surface, but I think that we've certainly talked enough to whet the appetites of our listeners, who I'm sure will be very interested in this book. So can you tell us a little bit about where we can find out more about you, where we can get the book? And I know that you're currently on tour. You're touring about the book right now, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of going all over. So you can find out about me at my website, randihutterepstein.com. It's Randy, R-A-N-D-I, Hutter, H-U-T-T-E-R, Epstein, E-P-S-T-E-I-N.com. And if you go to my speaking engagements, it lists where I'll be speaking. I'll be kind of all over. So I'm hitting New Jersey and Chicago and Michigan, San Antonio, which I've never been to. So I'm very excited to go all around the country, and I'm meeting some wonderful readers and also some amazing scientists along the way. And the book, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything, is available hopefully in your local bookstore. You can ask them. We have to keep these independent bookstores going, but it is also available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and other places that you may get your books online.
Awesome. All right, Randy, thank you again for taking the time. Thank you for making such a complicated and complex topic so entertaining and so accessible for the rest of us. So I appreciate that, and best of luck with your tour.
Thank you. I really appreciate that you reached out to me. I really enjoyed being on this podcast.
Awesome. Thanks, Randy. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thank you again to the show sponsor, the Metabolic Health Summit, this 4-day keto and metabolic therapy event that's happening in LA at the end of January in 2019. I may need to go to this, because I feel like it's going to be a lot of smart people, a lot of cool things. So if you guys are going to go, let me know. Send me a message on Instagram, and maybe we'll all hang out and eat some keto stuff together. But a reminder, if you do want to go, or if you just want to learn more about what the event is all about, you can go to their website, metabolichealthsummit.com, and you can use the code PALEOMHS19 and get 20% off any ticket. So that includes tickets to the actual event, as well as the VIP dinner, if you want to be real fancy. So yeah, check out metabolichealthsummit.com and hope to see you there. All right, so join me next week. I'm going to be talking with Sal DiStefano. He is one of the co-hosts of the hugely popular Mind Pump podcast. This guy has a lot of experience in the fitness industry as a trainer. He's got a lot of opinions, which I'm into. We have a great conversation. I love his podcast myself. I listen to it all the time. And I always felt like I was kind of a a silent partner in his podcast because he was talking about things that I was interested in. I love the kind of conversational tone of his podcasts, and I always kind of wanted to be a part of it. So I very selfishly asked him to be on my podcast so that I could ask him questions and finally be a part of that conversation he was having. So we talk a little bit about paleo. I get a little confrontational. It's kind of funny, but we mostly talk about social media and its role in the health industry. We kind of get really meta because we end up talking a lot about the goal and really the point of these health and wellness podcasts and what we're achieving, what we're hoping to achieve, and this kind of this huge influx in the way we get health and wellness information out there and whether it can be helpful and hurtful sometimes. And so anyway, we're kind of like health podcasters talking about health podcasts on a health podcast. It's really like a whole inception kind of thing. But it was a really fun conversation, and I hope you listen. So join me next week, and that's it for now. Have a great day.
Paleo Magazine Radio is brought to you by the Paleo Media Group and is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Our show music features the song Light It Up by Morgan Heritage and Joe Mercer Marley. And on behalf of everyone at Paleo Magazine, thank you for listening. Light it up.